Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Drew Meredith, welcome to this episode of the Australian Investors Podcast.
Thanks for having me again.
It's always a bit of fun, mate. Reporting season is upon us. We are in the second week of ASX companies releasing their results. We've got a lot of more interesting companies to talk about this week. Last week it was filled with small caps and US companies that were reporting quarterlies. We got the biggest bank, we got the telco, and a bunch of other interesting companies. Some boring companies, but some interesting companies. I received a few messages about the Aurizon results. That's the formerly known as QR National. First time I've ever been asked to talk about Aurizon in any form. I don't know if you know it that well, but
yeah, an ESG lens on it, or
well, I guess the sustainability, cheaper by rail than by road. There's actually a really interesting sustainability report on the Aurizon website for those of you that are interested in that. And yeah, we've got one US company this week, so we've got Disney, which you're bringing to the table. Maybe this week we can try and keep it a bit more concise, mate, because I know you're on holiday in Noosa. If you do hear kids in the background, that's what's happening. But mate, yeah, why don't we just crack straight into it then? Maybe we'll go with the biggest company on the ASX, I think, by market cap. Maybe BHP has taken this mantle now, but Commonwealth Bank of Australia out with its results. For those of you that are watching on YouTube, we will do a bit of screen sharing and what have you, and just to kind of illustrate some of the results in the flesh, but we'll make it so you can just listen along if that's your way to do it. But basically, Commonwealth Bank came out, reported some pretty strong results at the surface, but when you dig a little bit deeper, you'll see that maybe there were some things that probably could have been better. The loan book increased across the board, but it was home lending that grew slower than system. So what does that mean? Basically, the amount of money that CBA lends, if I just bring up system, the amount of money that CBA lends into homeowners and investors was actually down in comparison to the rest of the business, which grew above its peer group. So business lending was up, business deposits were up, household deposits were in line with the market, but home lending was slightly lower. I don't know about this, mate. I feel like this isn't such a bad thing when a bank coming into a period of economic uncertainty really, you know, is happy to go at the pace of the market, maybe a bit slower. I don't know if you have any views on that.
Yeah, I think there's when you look at the people who are trying to grow faster than system growth, I think we're talking about AMP later on. I think Macquarie's been one of them as well. So it's you're not losing market share to Westpac and the other big four competitors. You're losing it to either more nimble or more aggressive players. And, you know, we haven't got any impairments yet, but there's a risk that impairments of loans go up because interest rates are going up and people struggle to make their repayments eventually. Who knows how bad that'll be. But you definitely don't want to be the most aggressive going into a period that impairments might be increasing.
Yeah, you don't want to be the one that's lending at 2x system a year before inflation really bites homeowners. And, you know, we've talked about falling property prices throughout parts of Australia. You want to make sure that your bank isn't necessarily overly exposed going into that period, because typically when a new home is on the market is when it's most vulnerable to you know, getting squeezed for equity and whatever. But we can see here, if we just look at CBA's results, you know, I guess low single-digit growth is probably what you'd expect from a bank of this size. The one thing that reversed was the you mentioned loan impairments. Because of COVID and a few other things, the loan impairment expense actually reversed. So if we take the 2 years ago results, so June 2020, and we're obviously in 2022 now, we can see that in June 2020, there was $2.5 billion expense. This is when everyone was on like bank holidays and interest rate holidays and all that sort of stuff. And then last year in 2021, there was a negative. So there was a negative result, loan impairments, also a $554 million. But this year it's flipped around to a positive. So that's a reversal of around $900 million. And if you compare that to how far CBA's profit before tax went up, it went up by about $1.2 billion. So most of that actually come from a reversal in accounting rather than actual like strong operating performance from the business. You know, I think at the end of the day, mate, CBA shareholders will be happy with the result because final dividend of $2.01 per share, that's the total, bring the full year up to $3.85. It's a yield of around about 3.85%, fully franked, because the bank trades about $100 a share.
Not quite at pre-COVID level yet, is it?
No, that's the one, mate. So yeah, we can see like in times gone by, CBA was paying very aggressive dividends, and we measure the dividend of most companies based on the amount of profit that they earn as payout ratio. The payout ratio, I think the CBA targets is around 70 to 80% of cash profit. So they're in that range. And I think overall, you know, it's a bank, and we talk about this a lot. I think you've got a point around this, which is that it is the best bank in Australia, at least retail.
Maybe the world.
Maybe the world, you reckon? Yeah, and this is the thing, right? Was it UBS that came out like a few years ago and said that CBA is the most expensive bank in the world or something like that? Do you remember that?
I think it is. We here as a measure of value of banks, and it was something like 2.83 times, and every other bank in the world is like 1 to 1.2 times price to book.
Yeah, right. So
hopefully it's still the case, because you're about to prove me
right or wrong. No. Yeah, no, I'm just looking at using the ticket terminal, just looking at it. So price to book value, last 12 months. And you can see over time, yeah, I mean, it's always been pretty high over, probably if you take the average of the past 10 to 15 years, it looks like it's, well, it's somewhere between 2 and 2.5 times book value. So
that's why people always say it's expensive, even though it's consistently traded at a premium to basically every other bank in Australia and the world.
Yeah. And if we just, I guess, take the domestic lens, it actually, it's got like, it's streets ahead in technology. You know, it's always been pretty consistent with its dividends. It's got more deposits. So deposits are typically seen as a safer source of funding for banks. So
that's amazing when you see that the amount of, so basically they're funding all their loans through people's deposits in the bank rather than going overseas and raising more bonds or raising more capital, where the cost of that's going up. But essentially the cost of deposit funding is controlled by them if you're dominating the market as much as they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're more than happy to put that chart of like us versus our peer group on that one. The net interest margin was squeezed. They said it was a few different things in the mix, but one of the things was more fixed rate loans. So it'd be interesting to see how they unwind over the next 12 to 24 months. Like fixed rates have been very aggressive. Like there's a big disparity between fixed rate mortgages at the moment and variable because of the uncertainty. So it'd be interesting to see, I guess, how quickly those come back down. If they come back down,
I think it'll reverse pretty quickly. You can already see mortgage rates are heading up incredibly quickly if you look at those, all the charts and market analysis. But term deposit rates are only ticking up very slowly. So that's where your margin goes from 1.9 to 2.2 pretty quickly. And then your net interest margin 2.2 is that's where your profitability comes from. So it's
for sure. Particularly now with the banks relying more on just lending, like people, it might sound curious, but for a long time, the banks have relied on other things like fees and financial advice, insurance, et cetera, but they're kind of unwinding that now. So overall, you know, a pretty like expected result from CBA. Maybe you probably felt it for the valuation, but I guess the unknown is what happens in the next 12 to 24 months with the impairment expense and how that impacts any dividends that get paid. But for now, it's steady as she goes. How about you, mate? What's number one for you?
Oh, I have to stick with the big caps too. So that's Telstra for me. Hopefully you can't hear the baby crying in the background. There is someone else taking care of a child. Telstra, so it was increased dividend for the first time since 2015. I think that's all I have to say. And we can move on to the next stock.
Yeah, sure.
Telstra is kind of an example of the other forward-looking example of the other companies we're looking at, which is, you know, a massive monopoly that realized it needed to change 5, 6, 7 years ago, but it takes that long for these massive companies to actually make the changes they need. So they, something like their consumer plans and small business plans for all their customers, they had 1,800 plans you could purchase. So it's, you know, 12-month, 24-month, casual. They've got that down to 20 in the last 5 years. So you can imagine how simple that becomes. You know, they did a lot of offshoring, cost cutting, but that's probably... it's evidence of someone like AMP and how much work has to go in to change the direction of a ship. And that's why Andy Penn, I think, is tired after 5 years of doing it, handing over to his CFO. And I mean, some of the comments there, we mentally transform the company, simplify, digitize, and set bold aspirations. And he's finally achieved most of that. And the result was, so they look at underlying EBIT rather than statutory. The statutory is obviously for Telstra, includes all the money they're losing by the losing, I think, the copper network to the NBN. So their underlying EBIT was up 8%, which is far faster growing than what you'd expect for this type of, you know, infrastructure and mobile company. Actual EBIT was up 5%, 7 billion. Dividend was increased by 6%, which isn't bad given how long it's been. Yeah, particularly for this stock. And I think with what's going on, kind of the variability and volatility at the moment, there's a likelihood that more of returns will come from income over the next year or two, at least, than capital gains, which have dominated for the last decade. Probably some of the more interesting things there were they had this energy business that they were trying to grow. They basically said, we're on hold with that. We're not going to take on customers in an energy market at the moment. And then they're supposed to be rebuilding all the fiber throughout the cities. And they basically said, due to supply chain, labor, all those issues, that it's going to be earnings on that will be significantly lower. But they called their mobiles business outstanding in quotation marks.
Okay.
Which grew EBIT to 4 billion, so just dominates their business at the moment. And that was the decision that people questioned of just doubling down on 5G.
Yeah.
And obviously anyone who has a 5G enabled phone knows 5G is significantly better and people will pay for faster speed.
Yeah. We saw that with iPhone take up, right? When they moved to 5G, the super cycle from Apple just, you know, ripped records. So people willing to pay a very high price for it as well. I got to admit, I've got a 5G iPhone. I was part of that super cycle, but my SIM card's still an old one, so I don't know. The SIM card's not 5G.
Up the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not sure why. Started showing 5G. Sometimes you get 3G still.
Yeah, I've found that people have had some sort of mixed results with it, so it's pretty interesting. So that's a. What do you make of? Just one final thing on Telstra, like we talk a lot about the dividend. Do you think, though, like it has a place in portfolios, considering that, you know, it's been pretty anemic growth, if not going backwards, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I think so. I think particularly with the structural separation they're trying to do now, which was first, and the government suggested it back in 2012 or thereabouts when they were starting the NBN, they were going to force them to do it, and they're finally doing it 10 years later. So that's selling off your infrastructure towers, selling off your data centers, selling off all the non-core parts. And people talk about this almost conglomerate discount where you've got too many assets, no one knows how to value them. But when you start cutting them out, you're separating your core business, which is mobiles, internet, and other services, and, you know, realizing the value of your infrastructure assets when you can. So I think it's reset its dividend, which was the hardest part, which hurt investors, and setting itself up for a stronger period, but it just shows how patient you need to be in these sort of old school companies, still in the top 20.
It's surprising because a lot of the other companies have kind of caught pace with it in various guises, like more innovative companies that are continuing to grow. I think maybe one, you know, reason, like some of the big banks have struggled. It's probably kind of like CBA, Macquarie, and then there's the rest. And so you know, maybe the banks, you know, haven't been performing too well. Telstra's still a dividend favorite, so it finds a position in there. I just think, you know, if I can't see where the growth is coming from, I'd rather invest in something that is growing plus the dividend, as we've spoken about numerous times on the show.
Yeah.
If we move to number two, which is Insurance Australia Group, commonly known as IAG. It's an insurance company. It's got a few different brands underneath it, which they're trying to consolidate. And the business overall, they said, if you think about an insurance business, it's basically, there's normally two parts to it. There's the underwriting or the actual insurance and how they make money on that. And then there's the, I guess, the other part of the business, which is where they can invest a float and those types of things. If you follow Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, you'll know what I'm talking about. But they said that the insurance profitability came in below expectations at 14.4%. That's an underlying basis versus 13.8%. So that might seem positive, they had a huge natural perils and claims to report, a bill for that. So I'll bring that up on the screen for those of you that are watching. About 100,000 tabs open here.
It's like how you write off other banks impair loans just in case. Is that natural perils? Yeah.
This was actual. So they budgeted for $700 million or so, and it came in above that. And that's because of all the flooding in New South Wales, Queensland, and basically climate change, to be honest. So they've, going forward, they said that this was kind of like one of the most significant peril years we've have experienced. And going forward, they're forecasting, as opposed to about 700 million odd, they're forecasting $909 million in their allowance. And they basically said, you know, it's a result of climate change. And this is what we're having to do now. So there are a few different metrics you can look at an insurer. One is obviously the underwriting profit or loss. For many years, like QBE Insurance has recorded like pretty bad underwriting experiences. But the other one is gross written premium. This is just like the total amount of like written premium, the total amount of insurance that you're writing every year was up 5.7%. They have a plan to get to 9.5 million customers. This is IAG under its various brands.
Globally? That's multiple insurers, isn't it?
Multiple, yeah. And that's here in policies. Yeah, that's here in Australia. So the big thing is, I guess, the business is probably a higher quality insurer than, say, like QBE and those that are global. The business paid a dividend. I think the dividend, what was it? Dividend was, total FY22 dividends were 11 cents per share, which is down 45%, 70% franked, but that represents about 78% of underlying net profit. So it puts the stock on about a 2.3% dividend yield. They're forecasting mid to high single digit gross written premium and a margin that they want to say is pretty much consistent with this year. So overall, you know, again, it's probably like a CBA result. It's like what was expected. The market hasn't reacted to the share price today. So for the most part, analysts were expecting this. It's been pretty, like Telstra, like CBA, if you just look at the top line, so the business of sales or revenue, it's been pretty anemic for 5 years or so for IAG. So, you know, for the most
it's
part,
it's tough business.
Oh, it's
I struggle with insurance. It's, they say, what, up the stairs, down the elevator?
Yeah, that's right.
So you
right.
kind of see that with exactly there. QBE is even worse, where they ramp up their selling their policies because that's how you, obviously how you make money, and it goes up. And then every 5 years or so, it just falls off a cliff and goes up again and then falls and up and fall. Like, and part of that is they write so many policies and they need to raise capital in their statutory fund or in their investment fund, essentially to... Probably the challenge of that was generating returns, enough returns on that capital to fund the claims they were getting. And I just can't, as I see that, I'm not a trader, but I see it more of as a trading stock. You know, after it falls, they have great periods of recovery and then it falls again. I can't, and as you said, climate change, the kind of uncertainty around claims, just it's hard to predict and hard to warrant an investment, I think.
Yeah, like I agree. We're singing from the same songbook today because they have actuaries and, you know, people that data mine this stuff every day. They've got all the data sources, and even they're saying like the investment experience wasn't as expected. So, you know, the underwriting experience wasn't as expected. So, you know, how can we do that as individual analysts or investors? If you want a really good, if you want a masterclass in kind of how insurance can be done, you'd obviously look at Berkshire's Geico, but you could also look at a company called Markel Corp in the United States. It's kind of like a family business. I'll just bring it up on the screen. And it's a business that has a tremendous chief investment officer as well. So you can see that there. Once again, going up the escalator down the elevator, but it's for the most part, it's really proven its wear in both underwriting and investment. And the whole thing is, Drew, that people think with banks as well as insurers that because they have this huge float, as interest rates go up, so does their interest that they earn for nothing. But at the same time, if they've got a horrible underwriting business, if they've got a horrible
price that risk well, yeah. And then you might be losing money on the bonds you're holding already too. They're like, we don't always consider that.
Yeah, true. The Berkshire Hathaway with Warren Buffett did take a stake in the company quite a few years ago. And if you go back and read the original announcements, which is a good point, actually you will see that Berkshire got a pretty sweet deal on it. So it wasn't like, dividends are great for Berkshire, but it was a pretty good deal at the time. It was kind of, I think maybe Warren Buffett even did a video when the investment was announced. So I could be mistaken, but I feel like I remember that. So even though like it might have ties to Berkshire, maybe it's not kind of the same quality. So that's IAG.
I prefer Challenger, the annuity provider, which is more like an insurance company too.
So. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's got that same sort of like prescribed capital adequacy buffers and everything around its annuities. But it's also got the funds management business, which is really interesting too. So, mate, what's your number two?
I'm sticking with fund managers. They've had a shocking run. Pretty much all of them been sold off by 40, 50, 60%. Naturally, a lot of them are in outflows, years of underperformance, and they're losing money. But so GQG is one of the funds that we invest into in, you can hear the background here.
Yeah, you're right.
it was a fund we found by accident almost before Christmas one year. We usually don't take meetings in the lead up to office closure.
Yep.
And they basically, they had 60 or 70 billion under management and we'd never heard of them. Australian Super was one of their biggest institutional customers. And it's probably the most amazing thing is it's got, they just had 6.3 billion in inflows in the first half of 2022. They basically just do global equities and emerging market equities. Rajiv Jain's CIO had great background as all good fund managers do at multiple different places. Yeah. And their revenue was up 21%, 222 million. They only listed last year and the stock's already down 25%, mainly I think just on market concerns and margins. But revenue is up 21, profit is 83 million. So it tells you it's very simple. You more money, the more fees you get, and the more profit you make. And, marketing and employment costs are the only, essentially the only costs they have, and listing costs. It was kind of strange why they listed in Australia, but there's a Pacific Current Group. We're one of the early, or still one of the distributors or one of the early owners of the shareholders in the group. So that's the Aussie connection.
Right. Okay.
The amazing thing is they've got 6.3 in inflows, but they're also outperforming. So their global equity fund delivered a positive return, managed to get out of tech and into energy and materials, true active management, outperforming benchmarks. So kind of like Magellan was 5 years ago, probably.
Yep. That's probably what still compared to too, right?
Yeah. And I think one of the most surprising things is that their fees on the funds are something like 0.7% MER. Whereas the majority of the major global equity groups are above 1% still. Yeah. So you can say the industry is going to suffer from lower, fee pressure, but they're already there and they've just hit 90 billion under management in 6 years of operation.
So, do you say Rajiv, he's the
CIO.
Chief Investment Officer. Just according to ticker here, it says he owns nearly 69% of the company.
Yeah.
That's worth a cool $2.3 billion.
Yeah, became a billionaire in 6 years, I think.
Jeez, wow. He'd be wanting to pay dividends. And if he's an Aussie, maybe, is he Aussie or not?
No, Indian, yeah. I think. traditionally, yeah.
He should get his Australian citizenship and then become a tax resident, collect the franking credits. Jeez, wow. That's impressive. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. Like, I think
I don't know what the price for it is.
Yeah, right. It's I guess at the end of the day, for a business like this, as long as they're still putting in good performance, they've already got that inertia, right? Of, you know, you're using them as a financial advisor or you're meeting with them, then that means the person down the road's going to meet with them, and it has that network effect until one day it unwinds, of course, and they get become asset gatherers, and you know, it's harder to outperform.
That's the challenge. And one of the comments they made in the annual update was that they're actually being allocations to their strategies being cut because they're the best performer. This is kind of the challenge of advice and investment management, is that you tend to sell your winners or reduce your winners because they're getting overweight, yeah, and keep your losers, even though you probably should be doing the opposite. So they said they were confident they you know, look through that. And that's just part of, you know, being successful, is you're the first one to be cut.
Yeah, you need to raise capital. Too big. You're too big, yeah, in the portfolio. So yeah, makes sense. So that's a really interesting company to play along with. Hopefully they come to Melbourne, we can get an interview with them. That'd be nice. The third company on my list is one that was a request, which is Aurizon Holdings, formerly QR National, trades under the ticker symbol AZJ. Basically, they ship bulk, which is like agricultural products, industrial products, mining, anything mining related. And then they have the coal side of their business, which is a big freight business in Queensland. And so, but one of the things that's probably the most interesting development for Aurizon in recent times is they got approval to, you know, buy another railway, effectively. And as part of that deal, they have to divest some for competitive reasons, because Aurizon is a pretty dominant business along the northeastern seaboard of Australia. And it's basically bought the rail that connects South Australia straight up to Darwin. And Darwin's important because Darwin's the closest seaport to Asia. So if you're shipping coal, you're shipping anything, it's cheaper to do it by rail to port than it is by road. So Aurizon reported, in terms of total tons shipped on its network, 244 million tons, which was down from 253 million tons. So slightly down as a result of that and some other things. Revenue was down 2%. Net profit was down 2%. Free cash flow, according to their calculation, was $663 million, up 13%. EBITDA down 6%. In terms of how the business generated a resilient result, you could say, even though it's down 6%, was coal, which is a massive unit for them, was up 1%, whereas the others were negative. Interestingly, if you look at the business, there was a 33% increase in energy and fuel costs. So obviously it's not cheap to run trains, even though they may be cheaper than road transport. At the end of the day, they still got to wear that cost of higher energy prices. So just like the rest of us. Our final dividend of 10.9 cents, 100% franked, and that's 75% of underlying profit. And the final thing I'll give you is the outlook for Aurizon, which was that it's guiding for slightly higher EBITDA in the year ahead. So just kind of like basically saying at or around the current rate of EBITDA, maybe a little bit more. They reckon there's going to be higher coal volumes, but maybe there's a bit of squeeze on revenue. So I don't know
how's the share traded?
Let's quickly bring that up. So at the end of the day, you know, I can see it's flat today, but at the end of the day, businesses like Aurizon, for those people that are new to this type of investment, they sound fantastic because you're like, well, it's, you know, it's a railway, it's not going anywhere. You know, Warren Buffett's bought railways before and so on and so forth.
But he's bought everything at some point.
Except gold. We don't talk about gold.
No, he bought some gold miners last year.
He got bought gold miners, but not gold itself. So that's the key distinction. But if you go back in time, right, and if I'm just bringing up here on the screen the annual revenue growth of Aurizon, you can see it peaked at like 11% back in 2011, and it fell to this range of kind of where you could average it out at zero over the past 6 years. And the reason that this happens is that on one side of the ledger, you've got governments that impose regulatory, you know, caps and price increases and so forth. And on the other side, you do have a bit of competition from alternatives. It's not, you know, that common, but, you know, you could go by road and, you know, use trucks and so on and so forth. But and you also have customers that sign contracts, renew contracts and different volumes in the mix. So, for example, flooding and different types of things can affect volumes that miners want to push through the network. But at the end of the day, you end up with a business that compounds pretty slowly, but it's reasonably consistent through the cycle. So you might get single-digit growth.
You're never going to have a big PE on that. That's why it trades on a PE of 14. It's probably been in a band of 12 to 16.
Well, that's it, yeah. And so you're going to get that experience where it's kind of like you're not going to get the hype cycle around a rail operator, are you? And you're not going to get the kind of the deep despair because it's still going to keep ticking over. And at the end of the day, this is where if you are looking at this business, like I know some listeners are, you've just got to understand your valuation. Understand if I was modeling this business today, I haven't done anything on it. But if I was, I would be looking at, well, what is like the expected revenue increase over time? And by that, I mean like looking at things like the contracts that they're signing, the kind of the government oversight here on like caps or minimums of prices and whatever, and how that reflects volumes across the network. And then you've got to basically factor in inflation on those costs, on the cost base. And, you know, I don't think you're going to be like, you're not going to be telling your friends about Horizon if you invest in it. You're probably just going to collect your dividend check and it's going to compound slowly over time. And that's basically the business. I mean, if you have a view on this, I know a lot of people do, be sure to reach out to us on Twitter or send us a message, an email. Mate, that's Horizon. In at number three, I've got two more kind of a bit more exciting companies on the back end of my list. So what's on your number three?
I'll go the slightly more exciting. So News Corp, which would probably be pretty divisive as well. You'd similar to Horizon, you don't want to tell anyone if you own News Corp or particularly not on Twitter. I don't hold it yet. Oh, it's one I've looked at multiple times. They had an incredible run in 2020, 2021 as well. And I mean, they own part of REA, so REA Group. And I think you mentioned if you've got another one of those stocks in yours. But the biggest part is Dow Jones. So if you, I think it's Barron's, Market Watch, a lot of the big US financial news and Wall Street Journal. And that, so the whole group has the 11% increase in revenue, $10 billion, profit doubled for the year as well. So I think News Corp sold a lot of their production media assets to Disney, which I'm also going to talk about, a few years ago. And now they're very much news property. I think they're in part of Foxtel too, the majority of Foxtel still. So super interesting. 31, they've just kind of pivoted, got rid of all their old fashioned assets almost and pivoted towards digital subscriptions and just quality, consistent news, maybe quality and News Corp. They're probably listening to it. In some people's opinion. I mean, the massive highlight's always been REA Group. They own so much of it. REA Group revenues were up 37% in the last year. So the question on valuation and why I've always struggled is valuation ran incredibly strongly. But if you're at a peak in the property cycle, what does that mean for REA? I'm also on the other side. I've called a property bust forever and realize that it's not arbitrary, it's not boom or bust. You can just have slight shifts, and that's more likely going to be, it's been the case every other time. So it makes sense to be now, even though it doesn't make for good headlines in either direction. I use so many of their they're just such a good flow of content. And then there's some big pieces on Foxtel in the last few days, which almost IPO'd. But also managed, like a Telstra, managed to shut down, effectively losing all their customers from traditional, you know, wide in Foxtel boxes and growing strongly in cannibalize themselves, like Disney Plus with KO and Binge. So it's quite an interesting, for an old-fashioned media company, it's quite an interesting digital media company today.
Yeah, it'd have to be straight out of that kind of the value box, though, right? You'd want to be looking at this business through the lens of, well, how does it mix that revenue over time and how does that, you know, grow margins? And I'm just looking at gross profit margins have actually increased from 44% in 2019 to 51% in 2022. So the gross margins are on the business are better. And it's kind of, that's the kind of emerging value play you look for if you're into that type of thing. Why don't we just now shift gears and I'll just jump straight across to REA Group or realestate.com.au, as we know it here in Australia. It's not just realestate.com.au. If you go to Real Commercial, if you go to a bunch of others, like if you use One Form for renting, if you go to REA India, PropTrack, a bunch of different brands, you can basically tie all of the Australian property market data analytics to a couple of companies. And the big one is REA Group. Another one would be Domain. And so at the end of the day, what you mentioned there, like boom and bust, for me, there are two things that make REA Group special. And one of those is the listings, the number of listings. And the second one is how fast they increase the price of those listings. And they disclose that up front. There's been a few boycotts over the years of REA Group. You know, real estate agents have said, we're not paying that, we're going to Domain. And then Domain tries to do the same thing. But you can see here, like, they always pump up how good they are, how big they are, how much better they are. And on the screen in front of us here, I'm just looking at the SimilarWeb.com results for REA versus Domain, the core websites. And you can see here in the most recent month, this is July 2022, 56 million website visitors to REA Group and 21.6 million to Domain. So 21.6 versus 56. You can see the time on site, REA wins, pages per visit, REA wins, bounce rate, REA wins. And so it is still a dominant platform. And this leads me to the other point, which is that whereas it's probably a little bit I'll probably take this in a little bit of a different way, because over the year, they reported 25% revenue growth from their core operations. Listings were up 11%. But there's still bugger all in the way of rental listings. So renting is a big problem in Australia. There's not many rentals. But the price increases were 8%. So they're increasing average prices by 8% while also increasing listings 11%.
Inflation driven, supply chain issues.
Commodity prices. So it's clear that coal prices were going up, and so therefore digital ads have to go up as well. They just roll out something new every year and say that's the reason. This is one of those industries where some real estate agents really, they just pass that cost on to the vendor, the seller of the home. So at the end of the day, it's all of us that own homes and want to sell that cop it. And we keep doing it because they have the big audience. So this is a business, I think, that even in a property market downturn, they're going to get more listings. They might not be able to charge the same for the, increased prices throughout a downturn. Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but they'll still get listings growth in a downturn as well. So
how's it trading at the moment, valuation?
Valuation-wise, I can just quickly bring it up on the screen, just one second. REA Group, if the business is ever cheap, if you could say that, then you probably would buy it, right? But let's bring it up on the screen in front of us. Well, not Telstra. We don't want to be talking about Telstra.
Oh, no, I hate charts, but it looks like an ugly chart, doesn't it?
Let's have a look. Still loading.
It started to bounce.
Let's look at revenues. And we can see revenues over the last few years absolutely, like, just dominating, and that's reflective of the kind of the monopolistic type business that it is. And if we go to the chart,
so it was $116 before the pandemic hit, when we probably didn't have as strong a property market then, and it's only 10% higher.
Yeah, but
it's just grown profit by 25%, which is kind of.
Yeah, so it's pretty impressive. But the thing is, it peaked at $167, 6 to 12 months ago, and now it's back down to $132 a share. So there has been a bit of a reversal. But, this is like CBA, if it's no secret that REA is the biggest dog in town. And so at the end of the day, you've got to pay it the price, for that kind of general awareness that it is a monopolistic-like business. And I think the acquisition of Mortgage Choice is a really interesting one, as well as some of the international growth throughout Asia and India. India grew really quickly. The integration of Mortgage Choice is now increasing costs a little bit. But, this is another play from REA Group, which is the ability to potentially move deeper into the value chain. So, not just show you properties to buy and not just give you a quote on a mortgage repayment from CBA or from NAB, but actually, help you find a mortgage. That's really powerful. And that, is another revenue stream. As, it's no secret, like in the digital realm that we live in, if you have an audience, it's easier for you to have optionality. So if you have a business that is big and successful, wherever it turns its gaze from that point on is typically something that it can succeed at. Like we look at Apple as the prime example, 700 million subscribers or whatever. If that was its own business, it would be an enormous, Fortune 500 company. So good result.
I saw a presentation recently, I think it was Wavestone, that talked about the sweet spot of oligopolies, and it's like 65% is where you can, of the market, is where you extract the most margin, and that's, you showed the search data, and that was almost 65-66%. And like, there aren't that many oligopolies in the world, but they're not, like in the US, there's about 5 or 10 companies all fighting for the same market because it's still early there, whereas this one is just dominating it. So,
yeah, and it's got the optionality of those Asian markets as well. So really interesting business. Well, I've only got one more to go, but you've got two more, mate. What's on your list?
This one taught me a good lesson historically, personally, and as an advisor in the importance of stop losses in some cases. AMP. So, and it's also, it's probably a similar story to Telstra. It's, the question is how patient you're willing to be to wait for something to recover. So AMP, wealth management, asset management, financial advice, AMP North platforms, they had insurance, they sold their insurance business. I mean, they were among the worst hit during the Royal Commission because they're essentially one of the biggest employers of advisors, and all the issues that were rife in all the major, you know, the every bank and every major financial advice group had the same problems as we saw, which was fees for no service and charging dead people, and they were among the biggest hit by that. So they just had a 24% fall. Revenue fell 20%. It's still that period, like Telstra, where you're cutting everything, selling all the non-core stuff and trying to clean up your business. They did things like cutting the fees on all their platforms to make them more competitive with the market, reducing the number of advisors they were licensing. So a lot of their businesses are like resetting the base for earnings. Probably a Foxtel would be similar as well, where you have to lose customers to reestablish yourself. An interesting one was they targeted 2x system growth for lending, but they indicated they only got 1.15x, and that was a deliberate decision, which I'm not sure how you target it, then deliberately don't achieve it. But that was one of the comments they made in the update. And the new CEO's only been in for a year, and she comes highly credentialed.
Was it AMP that wanted to return a heap of capital to investors last year? I thought we talked about this on one of the shows, and they were saying that they were going to return some capital, or maybe I got that wrong. I couldn't find it in the data.
Yeah, they are. They just announced they're going to return a $1.1 billion, but they still haven't paid a dividend. It's been quite a few years.
It's been a few years. Someone
were putting comments about long suffering, in other words, for shareholders, but they're going to return $1.1 billion, $350 in a buyback, and then they're seeking approval for a special dividend and a capital return. And that's from the sale of what they called it, Column 8 Capital, and one of their infrastructure platforms. So,
Drew, do you know what that, I'm just asking off the top of your head, do you know what that is per share?
There isn't. Not yet. Yeah.
The reason that I ask is, like, if you look at the share price chart of AMP since 2005.
Don't look at it.
It's compounded. It's compounded at negative 10% per year. It's compound annual growth rate in reverse, if there is such a thing. But if you look at it another way, it's also the cheapest, or around about the cheapest it's ever been on a price to book ratio. So genuine, like, pushing into the cigar butt territory. I'm wondering if there's a bucket load of franking credits and capital, like you said, that can be returned.
I mean, what's the market cap considering the capital returns?
Is it small cap?
3.6 billion. So you're getting a third of your money back as a shareholder now, you know, assuming you didn't hold it for the last few years as well. But it's just, I think they're saying the right things in, you know, being in the industry and embracing technology, getting costs lower, trying to service the, you know, masses of people that need advice. But it's just incredibly messy. So the profit in wealth in advice fell 20%. They're cutting fees. Advice lost 30 million and their advisors are now down to 1,000 from 4,000 before the Royal Commission.
Wow. So yeah, like I was talking about this this morning, that I don't know the exact figures, but the estimates, what were, like, there was 26,000 financial advisors in Australia, maybe down to like
15.
Some estimates say it could even go lower to like 13.
Yeah.
it's a really challenging industry right now, isn't it? It's not like the industry for a company like AMP that has that checkered history too, right? Like it's tough.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, a lot of the advisors wouldn't even, you know, they're just advisors. They just happen to work for AMP and they probably fell into AMP. So I think it's a lot of the steps are positive and probably positive for the industry, but it's just messy and it's going to take some time.
Yeah. Well, I've had a lot of people, like maybe when they finally get this capital return over the line, maybe this is a catalyst for a pretty substantial re-rating for a lot of investors. Maybe that's what everyone's hanging out for because, I mean, there hasn't been a lot going for it recently. So
you're getting something for free when you buy it. People have said it different ways. Like it was, you're getting the advice business for free, you're getting the wealth management business for free, you're getting something for free. Even they got their own bank and the net interest margin, that's only 1.3% compared to CBA at 1.9%. So you can see how difficult it is to extract profit.
Some of the, like over the years, some of those AMP Capital funds have been pretty good. Like they've been, under the banner there, they've been pretty helpful. So a lot of people were trying to value it off those types of things.
Melbourne Airport is one of their biggest. They've had a long holding in Airport, one of their big funds, I think. And invest a lot of money for institutional investors.
Yeah, okay. So, there are reasons for you to, try and salvage parts of it. If you're that way inclined as an investor, that's probably not the way I invest. But, really interesting. So my final company, fifth and final company, is – I guess a household favorite. It's RMD. That's the ticker symbol, ResMed Inc. It's dual listed on the ASX and US markets. Came out with its fourth quarter results. Revenue up 4% to $914 million, up 8% in constant currency. They reckon they added $60 to $70 million directly from a competitor's recall. So what does ResMed do? ResMed creates like sleep apnea systems that you'd have beside your bed. You wear the mask, you got the ventilator. And they've just released something called AirSense 11. And AirSense 11, I was checking it out just before, it's a product that's basically fully cloud integrated. So you put on the mask, you got the ventilator or the respirator, and you've got this machine that sits there and it's constantly sending data back and forth to the cloud. And it's monitoring you, it's making recommendations or suggestions. And so this is a whole push by ResMed to go from just hardware, continue to push into like software and cloud computing. Really interesting business. The product recall on one of the competitors' products actually was that when they put the masks on, over time they would degrade and customers were reporting like little black particles, in their masks and everywhere. And the great fear is that people have ingested some of those particles over time without even realizing. So the implications of that are could be something meaningful. So ResMed, really strong company, gross margin up 57%. Over the full year, if we take full year results rather than quarterlies, revenue up 12%, gross margin slightly retracted with cost of goods sold, but operating income up 11%. And overall, again, this business is a serial compounder. It's got Philips, it's got a few other competitors in there, but this industry as a whole is growing as people put on weight, as people become more conscious of their sleep. Sleep apnea is a thing that's like a natural tailwind, kind of like Cochlear with all of the addressable market that it has. ResMed is definitely surfing that global healthcare wave. So really strong business, strong result.
I spoke to an analyst that was saying that it could take 4 to 5 years for the competitor to catch back up.
Yeah.
Like the challenge of having an issue with your respirators is that your sales team is now dealing with replacing them and dealing with existing customers, not dealing with selling new product. And that takes a long time to catch back up and then get ahead of. So it could be a sustained period of market share gains before the major competitors come back.
Mm. Overall, ResMed's going to keep lapping that up. And it could even take longer than 5 years. They might never recoup that lost ground. So strong business. Well done to anyone that's kept holding it for many years because it is a multi-bagger and a half. It's one of those, we could say Australian, but global success stories that Australian investors just happen to have exposure through the CDI structure. So really good business, well run, industry leading. So good company. Put it on your watch list. In at number five for you, mate, what do we got?
It's one of my favorites. It's been a rough couple of years as a shareholder, but Walt Disney corporation. Pretty well diversified. So Parkes, obviously Parkes had an incredibly difficult few years with COVID, but they're finally, you can see that, don't show me the share price. I don't need to see that again. It's been a bit up and down, we'll say that. I mean, the Parkes revenue just almost doubled in the last quarter, smashed expectations. But they also own ESPN. They launched Disney Plus. They obviously have the Marvel Studios and production assets. Everyone loves Thor. It's probably the, you know, they made a call several years ago buying up all the major brands, including Star Wars, and realizing that content was key and being able to sell product around that content and TV shows and just become massive content producers, probably before Netflix did. And they've actually just grown, when you include all of their subscriptions, to bigger than Netflix. So they're now at 217 million, including Disney Plus and the ESPN subscription services. Whether that counts or not,
I'd include it.
Not be a fair, yeah.
But it's
I don't think we get ESPN in Australia though, can we?
No, we can go to the website and whatever, and you can see snippets on social media. But yeah, incredible business, right?
Yeah, definitely, and it's starting to grow again, and you're kind of getting a reset in the share price for that growth. And they've also, so rather than, they've had the pain, kind of. I read the Bob Iger's biography, who came up with the idea for Disney Plus. Mm. The idea that you had to cannibalize your entire business to reset it. It was a success story until they're launching their own ad-supported tier, kind of just jumping on the bandwagon of Netflix and getting a step ahead rather than waiting until they have to, which was quite interesting.
Well, I know this is just a heuristic, so please don't, like, you know, at me on Twitter or whatever, but
as soon as you say that, that's what happens.
Yeah, then that's what people do. So the, like, if we just look at simple price to sales ratio, like trailing price to sales ratio, it's actually at the, other than right in the depth of the COVID crash, like right in the depth of it, it's actually at the lowest, it's trading at the lowest multiple of sales since 2013, 2014. And this is a business that is now a better business. It is experiencing a massive influx of people at Parkes while also having a super impressive subscription business, you know, annuity, high income, a high margin business. So, you know, even though it's a behemoth, maybe it's time to take another look.
Definitely. And pretty much every business division is growing, growing revenue and profitable. So it's probably the most interesting part. And if you've ever been to Disneyland, all the hotels, parks, everything else that goes around it is incredible.
Yeah, incredible experience. I think, like, in a world where content creation is key, like content ownership and brand ownership is becoming more and more important. I think, you know, the writing's been on the wall for a little while that Disney was going to be able to move further down the ecosystem and go into those over the top type streaming services and what have you. And now that they've crossed that bridge and done it and snatching share away from everyone else, it's pretty impressive because they basically control everything from comic book through to what you watch on the big telly. So the thing that, you know, people really like bought up the share price, it wouldn't be too hard if you're thinking like the share price is down, mate, because this is a company that came out with blockbuster after blockbuster after blockbuster after blockbuster. And this happens with these IP-rich companies. Like we see it with gambling and pokey machine. Like they come out with like one thing and it does really well. Or like in this case, it was like Marvel, you know, constantly coming out with like big hits that broke box office records. But they still got all that franchise. It's still alive. So really impressive business. I like it.
They don't have the challenge as much as Netflix where they're trying to create new content because they've already got ideas and a massive backlog of stuff to push out. So
yeah, totally. It's just like they might stuff some things up, of course. Like there was some pretty critical reviews of Obi-Wan, that series. And some people have said, you know, the new Marvel movies aren't what they used to be. But I think even for nostalgic reasons, people are going to keep their Disney Plus subscription.
Everyone loves Chris Hemsworth. It's kind
of... you gotta love Chris Hemsworth. Yeah. And, you know, good directors, good staff on that one. So I think overall, really interesting business for global companies. We actually did a deep dive on Disney about 18 months ago on our Australian Finance podcast, and it was super popular. Everyone loves it because everyone can relate to it. They've got a memory with this attached to this company. So, yeah, I like it. One for the watch list, mate. Do you own any of these shares, by the way? I should mention I don't own any of them. Disney, yeah, right.
And news and GQG have always sitting there on my watch list, but I've never pulled the trigger.
Yeah, I'm kicking myself because I sold ResMed shares years ago, and it was probably better ideas, and that was probably around 2014, 2015 when it was $5 a share. It's now $33 a share. So, I mean, if you find an industry leader, stick with it, I think, is
one of my... Don't sell your winners.
Yeah, as long as they keep dominating whatever industry they're in. I mean, no one probably could have predicted this recall, otherwise it wouldn't have happened. But at the same time, like, you know, ResMed's in that sweet spot of growth in a massive TAM. So, yeah, lots of interesting companies in today's list. If you do like to hear us talk about companies and just give you a brief overview of the results, please just send us an email, podcast@ras.com.au. You'll find a link in the show notes to Drew's website, Wattle Partners, if you want or need financial advice. Be sure to get in touch with the Wattle Partners team. Mate, you're in Noosa, so are you up there for another week?
Someone just got in the pool in the rain. So.
It's raining, is it?
Yeah, it's raining. Otherwise, I probably would have cancelled.
Well, thanks for joining us, mate. It's always a pleasure. So next week, we'll probably do it back in person here in Melbourne. But yeah, until next week, just enjoy your time up in Queensland, mate. Appreciate it.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that RASK could help you in 2024. As many of you know, RASK has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies, which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at RASK, which is the launch of our RASK Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high-growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside RASK Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called RASK Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 RASK community members have begun the RASK plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RASCOR, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software, and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASC YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASC network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the RASC Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASC Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASC Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASC and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASC network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.